If you do this consistently, students will intuit the pacing expectations in your classroom and respond accordingly. A final piece of all hands is managing questions, requests, and comments that are either off task, are we going to be writing in our journals later, or persist on a topic you are ready to dispense with. I wanted to read what I wrote about Tabitha too. Such benign distractions can pose a serious threat to pacing, and even hands raised to ask questions can waste time and disrupt the energy and timing of an otherwise perfect class. The best teachers seem to be especially attentive to this, using a version of the do not engage portion of strong voice, technique 38, and telling students no hands right now or something similar when the time is not right. Every minute matters. Time is water in the desert, a teacher's most precious resource, to be husbanded, guarded, and conserved. Every minute matters. And yet, in a variety of situations, we risk letting the minutes slip by. The last few minutes of class, for example, are sometimes blithely given away. We say, we don't have time to start anything new, or we worked hard, so I'm giving you guys a few minutes to relax. Let's say this kind of thinking applies to just the last 4 minutes of class. That adds up to roughly 12.5 hours of last few minutes during each of perhaps 6 classes in each school year. If you did that every day, you'd give away 75 hours of instruction, several weeks of school. Instead, use Every Minute Matters and reward students for their hard work with a high-energy review of all they've learned or with a challenge problem. Keep a series of short learning activities ready so you're prepared when a 2-minute opportunity emerges. At the end of class, in the hallway, while waiting for buses. A walk to the bathroom is a perfect time for a vocabulary review. Packing up backpacks at the end of the day is a great opportunity for reading aloud to the students from an inspiring novel. There's no better way to keep kids from getting off task while lining up for lunch than by peppering them with multiplication problems and mental math. Getting out to the bus to go home? Have every student think of an adjective to describe the bus. You can always be teaching. There are roughly 12.5 hours of last few minutes during each of perhaps 6 classes in each school year. Every few months I re-inspire myself by watching a short video of Jamie Verilli managing his minutes one afternoon at North Star Academy. Waiting with most of his students outside a history classroom for the last few students to arrive, he begins quizzing students on their vocabulary words. What does it mean to be bound to do something? Can you use it in a sentence, John? Who would have been bound to the land in a Middle Ages town? What are you bound to be doing right now? The students are standing in a line in the hallway just outside his classroom. Class has not even started yet. Not in the classroom, not during class time, and Jamie doesn't care. There's learning to be done. Meanwhile, his students are excited, smiling, happy to be engaged, and showing off their knowledge. Look forward. Even mild suspense creates tension, excitement, and anticipation. You can harvest that in your classroom to make your pacing feel more vibrant by using look forward. If you put an agenda on the board for a lesson or the morning, you can start students looking forward. If you add a catchy name to some of the topics on your agenda, they seem all the more intriguing. If you call one mystery activity, you can make the anticipation even more intense. You can go further by referring to it occasionally. We're almost there. Charles thinks he knows what it is, but oh no, he has no idea. Bob Zimmerly once entranced a class of 5th graders during a lesson on place value by writing a number with 12 digits on the board and announcing, "At the end of class today, somebody's going to stand up and read this number correctly to the class. Everyone's going to be able to, but one of you is going to get to represent. You're going to march up here and show us how. Be ready. It might be you." Here are a few other ways to refer to the future. Later we'll be making this really tricky, so stay with me now, even if it seems easy. Or hard. By the end of class, you'll be able to, or you'll know the true story behind. This is the first step in a skill that you'll want to show off to all your friends. There are simpler ways to look forward. Consider the difference in the example we looked at in Brighton Lines in this chapter. While take exactly 3 minutes to answer the questions in front of you, then we'll begin discussing the novel, is better than take some time to answer the questions in front of you, then we'll begin discussing the novel. Both are better than Take some time to answer the questions in front of you, with no reference to what's next. After hearing the first version, the second almost pleads for an answer to, and then what? Even if it's only, and then we'll move on to the next step. Work the clock. The teachers interviewed for this book constantly talk about time in their classrooms, and they work the clock. They count it down, parcel it out in highly specific increments, often announcing an allotted time for each activity. Take 3 minutes to answer the questions in front of you. They mix in frequent countdowns to pace their class in completing tasks and emphasize the importance of each second. Pencils down and eyes on me in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The countdown lends a sense of urgency to class time, reminding students that time matters and hastening them along to the next step. What's more, a countdown allows them to acknowledge productive behavior in an especially effective way. Imagine you acknowledged 2 students, Brooklyn and Brian, because they were ready in exactly the manner you'd asked. If you acknowledged them in the middle of a countdown, for example, by saying, 5, 4, Brooklyn's ready, 3, 2, Brian's sitting up and ready to roll, and 1, eyes on me and away we go, you are calling attention to behavior that not only meets, but exceeds expectations. You gave students until you reached 1, but Brooklyn was ready at 4. She did more than comply with your wishes. She set the bar high. Only by counting down the seconds did you make it evident to everyone that Brooklyn and Brian were ready early. Without the countdown, calling attention to their readiness, I see that Brooklyn is ready, Brian is ready too, leaves you sounding weak, almost as if you were pleading with other students to comply with your expectations by praising a few students who had complied or at least come close. After all, there's no way to tell without the countdown whether you're reinforcing excellence or mediocrity. Finally, using countdowns can allow you to continually set goals for your class's speed in meeting expectations. I know we can do this in 10, but we're homeroom Hamilton. Let's see if we can get ready in 6. Now your standard can be ever-increasing success rather than more than mere compliance. In a recent lesson in Patrick Pastore's reading class at Rochester Prep, Patrick began his countdown at 10. When he got to 4, all of his students were ready, so he announced, "And we don't need the rest. Let's get started." Reflection and practice. 1. Go through a lesson plan you're likely to use in the next week, and if you don't do this already, assign the time you think each activity is likely to take. Now that you have general parameters, go through and find every direction you'll give to your students during the lesson, and designate an amount of time you will allot to each activity. Write a short script for each that makes the amount of time available clear and gives a beginning and end prompt to brighten lines. 2. Take the biggest single block of activity in your lesson, as measured in minutes, and try to break it into 2 or 3 activities with the same objective but with slightly different presentations. For example, if you had a section of problems for a math lesson on rounding, you might divide it in half, with a clear line between numerical and word problems. Then you might insert a brief reflection on what rounding is and why we'd do it between the 2 sections to make it seem like 3. Chapter 9. Challenging students to think critically. Additional techniques for questioning and responding to students. Questions asked strategically of students by teachers have been the heart of teaching for about as long as there have been teachers and students. Effective questions tend to come in groups that make the whole greater than the sum of the parts, and questioning is the art of sequencing those questions in groups. Good questioning builds solid mastery of even complex ideas by uncovering and explicating each component piece of a concept in progression. Assembling questioning sequences, then, is like building steps. If each step yields a steady and manageable rise and the organizing structure is sound, the staircase can lead students up any height. The building process is essentially the same whether there are 3 steps or 300. The bigger goal means not bigger steps, but more of the same steady, manageable steps. By climbing steps day after day, students get good at climbing, good at systematically developing and breaking down ideas. Soon they rise without watching their feet or counting their steps as they move ably and with quickness. Although the idea behind questioning is generally a constant, questioning can serve at least five distinct purposes in effective classrooms. To guide students toward understanding when introducing material. The purpose is to methodically build knowledge and mastery of a pre-planned skill or concept, the objective, often by building gradually on a simpler idea and anticipating the places students will be confused. Example: we know that we can add fractions when they have the same denominator, that 1/3 plus 1/3 equals 2/3, but what about when the denominators aren't equal? Would 1/3 plus 1/2 equal 2/5? Is that possible? Let's look at our answer. Is 2 more or less than half of 5? Less. So 2/5 is more or less than 1/2? Less. But we can't add something like 1/3 to 1/2 and get an answer that's less than 1/2. So we must have a problem. We can't just add the numerators and the denominators. To push students to do a greater share of the thinking, increase the ratio, Technique 17. The purpose is to have students own, deeply, and fully acknowledge information they have previously been introduced to and begun to master by forcing them to do the lion's share of the work. This form of questioning is more likely than the first to happen during the we or guided practice portion of the lesson, while the first is more likely to occur during the I part of the lesson. See also ratio. Example: so if I'm adding 1/2 and 1/3, what's the first thing I need to do, Kelsey? And how do I find the lowest common denominator? Is that a complete answer, James? Does it capture everything I need to do? What's missing? Okay, so now that we know what to do, what is the lowest common denominator in this problem? All right, then, what do I do next, Max? To remediate an error. The teacher responds to a wrong answer, evidence of a student's incomplete mastery of a concept, by breaking the original concept down into smaller component parts and adding insight through more questions to build toward mastery of the original concept. These tend to be shorter reactive questioning sequences. See Break It Down, Technique 16. Example: remember that the LCD is a number that can be divided by both of the denominators. You said the LCD was 5. How many times does 3 go into 5? To stretch students. The teacher responds to a student who has appeared to demonstrate mastery of a concept, answered one or several questions correctly, by pushing him to apply the concept at the next higher skill level or in a new setting, often to test for reliability of the correct answer. They also tend to be shorter reactive questioning sequences. See Stretch It, Technique 3. Example: nice job adding 1/2 plus 1/3, Mark. Tell me, what would your LCD be if you wanted to add 1/2 to 1/7? To check for understanding. The teacher uses questioning to test for mastery, sampling a strategic array of students to discern how much of what she's taught students have learned. See Check for Understanding, Technique 18. Example: okay, before we move on, let's see who's got it right. Albert, to get my LCD, I simply add the two denominators, right? The line of questioning can pursue more than one of these purposes at a time. A teacher might seek to both stretch her students and check for understanding at the same time, say by asking a student who answered correctly to explain the solution process. Questioning is a complex and multifaceted skill that affects almost every part of teaching. Many of its most critical elements are covered at different places in this book. For example, questioning is embedded in Stretch It, pushing students when they've answered correctly, Ratio, increasing the amount of cognitive work students do, Break It Down, responding to student errors, and Check for Understanding, strategically testing for mastery. In addition to those aspects of questioning, there are a few general rules of thumb for designing effective questioning, no matter its purpose. One at a time. Given that questions often come in sequences, it's easy to overlook a simple but critical rule of thumb for questioning. Ask one question at a time. Ironically, teachers are most at risk of asking students more than one question when they're excited about what they are teaching and when the content attempts to push ahead too quickly. Disciplining yourself to use one at a time, particularly when you're most engaged and enthused, helps focus students on developing one idea at a time, and focuses you on questioning with a specific goal or purpose in mind, not just a generalized desire to spark any discussion. Consider a teacher reading Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of NIMH with her fifth graders. She might ask something like, "Jason, how is the rat's house different from Mrs. Frisbee's, and which one do you think she would rather live in?" This question is really two, each with a distinct purpose. One asks Jason to compare and contrast specific details, and the other asks him to infer a character's point of view about an event. Unless the teacher is disciplined about attending to both questions and ensuring that each gets answered in turn, Jason will most likely choose, perhaps arbitrarily, which of the two questions to answer, and the other will fall by the wayside, never to be answered, and subtly but persistently suggesting to the class that the teacher's questions are not especially important or planned. The message is not, "I have something specific and singularly important I want you to discuss," but, "I just want you to discuss the book. Any of a variety of topics will do equally." In fact, if Jason is savvy, his choice of which question to answer won't be arbitrary. He'll choose either the one that's easier for him or the one he wants to answer more. Not necessarily the one that would be better for him to answer. This double question essentially devolves a critical learning decision, what's the question we're answering, to accident. Comparing and contrasting and inferring a character's perspective are critical but different reading comprehension skills. And it makes sense for a teacher to make an intentional decision about which is more productive to ask Jason at that moment, rather than leaving it to him to make a spur-of-the-moment choice. Furthermore, since she doesn't know which question Jason will engage, she is immediately hampered in her planning. She can't prepare, in her mind or better as part of her pre-class lesson planning, a series of follow-up questions to make visible to students how Mrs. Frisbee's character is reflected in her preference for her own simple abode, because she doesn't control whether the issue reaches the discussion floor. And even if she's disciplined about asking Jason to answer both questions, she'll be able to plan follow-up to only one or the other. Thus, in the end, one of her questions is highly likely to get shorter shrift than it deserves. One reason many teachers may be inclined to ask more than one question at a time is that it's easy to unconsciously model in classrooms the techniques of interviewing seen in popular media. Though similarly driven by questions, interviews propose to inform and entertain, not to teach, which is very different. The interviewer hopes to generate a string of interesting, revealing, or don't-touch-that-dial remarks from an individual. Trying various questions to see which draws the most interesting response is an effective strategy. So interviewers may offer several questions at a time, hoping to elicit a vibrant response. In scholastic questioning, offering a menu of questions is more likely to cause confusion or inefficiency. It is unclear which question to answer, easy to skip the hard ones, and more difficult to sustain a conversation on a specific, focused topic. In short, the ramifications of this mundane rule are far-reaching. Fortunately, the solution is simple. Ask one question at a time. Simple to complex. It's effective to ask questions that progress from simple to complex. Like a good lesson plan, effective questions initially engage students thinking about a topic in contained and concrete ways, and then push them to think more deeply and broadly. In the process of answering narrower and more focused questions, students begin to activate their memory of relevant facts and details to support their opinions. They have time to develop and reflect on ideas, turning them into insights before they're called on to share them in public. As a result, they will likely answer broader and deeper questions more factually, more insightfully, and having seen themselves succeed at initial questions, more confidently and with the willingness to take on greater risk. In a typical sequence about a novel or a historical period, for example, you might ask a few fact-based questions to ensure that your students understood the facts and details of what happened. These might be organized from simpler to harder. Then you might start asking questions that ask students to evaluate and prioritize that information. What was the most important event in the story? What did we learn that most helped us to understand the main character? What were the most important events in the historical period, and what do they tell you about people's values then? After that, you might move to a few questions that ask students to apply their ideas more broadly. How would you compare or contrast the main character's behavior in this chapter to his behavior at some other point in the novel? What are the most important lessons from this period in history that are still relevant today? While this latter group of questions is arguably more interesting, they'll yield less value if you jump right to them without establishing and affirming both a fact base and the logical building blocks from which students can conduct their deeper thinking. Verbatim, no bait and switch. Most teachers ask a question, wait for hands, then call on a student to answer. However, before the chosen student answers, they often restate the question. It's often useful and occasionally critical to do this, especially when asking a challenging question. However, in repeating the question, it's important to remember to ask the same question verbatim. Some teachers unintentionally pull a bait and switch on their students, changing the question after a student has raised his hand and begun to formulate a response. This seems harmless, but can have several negative consequences. First, the student with his hand raised is now asked to respond aloud to a question that is different from what he volunteered to speak about. He is not prepared, and the quality of the answer is likely to be lower. Even a moderate change in syntax can force a student to revise the syntax of the answer he's been preparing, leaving him confused or distracted at exactly the moment he's on stage. If you ask your students to take the risk of answering questions about which they are less than 100% confident, and you should ask them to take that risk, they deserve to know what the question will be, have time to consider their response, and answer the question they think they'll get to answer. In many cases, students are left in stumped silence by a change in the question that may appear insignificant to the teacher. For example, a change from, "Why do you think the author wrote this article?" to, "What was the purpose of this article?" If your questions matter, you want students to hear them, consider them, and participate based on thoughtful reflection. Make that easier for them by keeping the question constant. Clear and concise. Too often the problem with the wrong answer is not with the answer, but with the question. It sounds obvious to note that students should know what you are asking them if you want them to have the chance to answer correctly. Here are five ways to use the clear and concise technique to improve the clarity of your questions. Start with a question word. When you begin a sentence with who, when, what, where, why, or how, your students instantly know it's a question and can begin thinking about a response. You also increase the likelihood that the kind of answer you want will be clear. Asking, "Can you add to that?" provides little guidance. It is unlikely to yield the kind of answer you want and to provide students with the chance to prepare a response they are confident in. Sentences that begin with "is" are fine too, although they often yield yes or no answers. Short responses that are hard to follow up on and don't usually yield great discussion. Limit them to two clauses. Asking questions in ornate sentences that sound as if they came from a Henry James novel may work for college professors, but often confuse students younger than college age. Make your questions rigorous and demanding, but limit them to two clauses most of the time, so students are clear on what you're asking. Write them in advance when they matter. The best way to ask exactly the right questions is to script them in advance as part of the lesson planning process. Both the initial question and your response if students aren't able to answer as you'd hoped. This is perhaps the single driver of better teaching that most developing teachers roundly ignore. Ask an actual question. Say, "Why doesn't Stuart think so?" rather than making a statement like, "But Stuart doesn't think so." If you do the latter, the students have the right to be confused. Are you asking them a question? Assume the answer. Ask, "Who can tell me?" not "Can anyone tell me?" The first assumes someone can answer, and a student thinks, "Who can? I can." "Can anyone?" expresses doubt that anyone will, and doubt makes students less likely to assume that someone like them should put their hand up. Stock questions. I recently showed a video of one of the best questioners I know, Jamie Berlante, to a group of teachers. In the video, Brillante's questions come at students fast and furious. Is that a run-on sentence? I think so. Well, how would you know? There would be two subjects and two predicates. If I wanted to prove it, which of those would I start looking for first? The predicate. And can you find a predicate? Is it owner? Why can't owner be a predicate? It's not a verb. Well, that would explain it. What part of speech is owner? No answer. Well, think of other words. Dancer, singer, teacher. What are those? They're all people. They're all nouns. And does an owner seem the same? Yes. And so the predicate must have what? A verb. In Brillante's lesson, students are working hard and fast, getting a serious intellectual workout, demonstrating knowledge and fixing errors. Observing Brillante in action is daunting for a teacher. How can the rest of us hope to think on our feet like that and ask artful sequences of clear questions over and over again while running a class? Afterward, I asked Brillante what the secret to her questioning was. She replied, "One important thing is that I'm not making my questions up on the spot. I am asking versions of the same few questions over and over. I've drilled them to know that it's easier to find the predicate than it is to find the subject. So I always ask them, when they're testing for a complete sentence or a run-on, should we try to find the predicate or the subject first? And they know that they need to find the predicate first because verbs are easier to find. I try to have a logical approach to typical problems and then follow that approach over and over. It looks as if I am thinking of five fast questions to ask in a row, but I am really making a decision to ask one sequence of questions in a row." In short, Brillante's questioning is based on theme and variation, similar sequences of questions applied over and over in different settings. Obviously, these stock questions can't occur in all cases and with all material, but she is making far fewer decisions than she appears to be. She's not deciding on five questions, but on one sequence of questions with five fairly predictable parts. This reduces the intellectually daunting demands of questioning and makes it practical to execute. Hit rate. A last aspect of questioning to attend to is hit rate, the rate at which students answer your questions correctly, or adequately and thoroughly in the case of questions where there's no firm right answer. If your hit rate is 100%, that's not necessarily a good thing unless you've just wrapped up a review. Or, put another way, it's good if your hit rate starts at 100%, but it should not remain that way for long. When kids get everything right, it's time to ask harder questions. Asking harder questions as your hit rate approaches 100% allows you to test the full extent of student knowledge and retain adequate rigor. By the same token, a hit rate below 2 out of 3 shows that you've got a problem with either how you presented the material you taught or how aligned your questions are to that material. Your kids are not showing you mastery, a result that should give you pause. How to reinforce effective questioning. A variety of techniques discussed elsewhere in this book are also critical to effective questioning. A brief discussion of several of them follows. Break it down. The capacity to break down ideas or questions that confuse students into smaller or simpler questions is arguably the critical questioning skill. Too often, teachers respond to the entirely normal and useful process of students answering incorrectly in one of three inefficient ways: repeating the same question, telling the student the answer, or calling on another student to answer, and not returning to the initial student. When a student fails to answer correctly, break it down, technique 16, is the best strategy. It assists the teacher in understanding what part of the question posed difficulty and causes students to both draw on and develop what knowledge they do have. A variety of break it down strategies are discussed in Chapter 2. No opt out. A related technique discussed in Chapter 1 is no opt out, technique 1. In several of the variations on it, the teacher returns to a student who was unable to answer an initial question, asking her to repeat the correct answer given by another student, or to use additional information provided by the other student to solve the problem herself. No opt-out questions might include, "Who can tell Charlene the first step she needs to use to solve this?" "Who can tell Charlene where she could find the answer?" Or, "Who can tell Charlene what we mean by..." a troubling concept or term. Right is right, and stretch it. If break it down and no opt-out are useful for remediating wrong answers by students, right is right, technique 2, adds two pieces to the picture. The all-the-way-right portion of the technique is useful for getting students who give mostly correct answers all the way there. I think you've characterized accurately how the main character acts in public, but is there more to say about how he acts in private? The answer-my-question portion of the technique is useful when students answer a question other than the one you've asked, a much more common problem than most people suspect. Stretch it, technique 3, by contrast, improves your questioning by reminding you that the learning process doesn't end with a right answer. Pushing students with a variety of follow-up questions is one of the most valuable ways to increase the rigor of your classroom. Ratio. Several aspects of ratio, technique 17, are also useful for questioning. Unbundling is the process of taking a large multi-part question and dividing it into a series of smaller questions that are rapidly distributed to a variety of class members, usually using cold call, technique 22. Rather than asking one student what the three dimensions of volume are, for example, a teacher might unbundle by saying, "How many dimensions of volume are there, Tyra?" "Good. What's one of the dimensions, Keith?" "What's another, Carlton?" "And the last, Jennifer?" "Good. And what number do we use for pi, the last dimension, Paula?" This technique has the effect of increasing the pacing of the lesson and involving more students. It also forces students to listen carefully to their peers' responses and adjust accordingly. Carlton can't offer length as his answer if Keith says it first. A second aspect of ratio that's particularly useful in questioning is to feign ignorance. That is, pretend not to know the answer or make a mistake, and thus require students to correct and explain the error. Cold call. Cold call is especially useful in situations above and beyond unbundling. It's the fastest, most effective way to make students accountable for staying engaged with your questioning. Keep the pace of your questions fast and rigorous, and ensure your capacity to use questions to check for understanding. It ensures your ability to steer any question to the student you most want to answer it at any time. Reflection and practice. Interview someone at a social event and practice asking this person only one clear question at a time. What made the task easy or difficult? What can you learn that you can apply to teaching? Part 2. Helping students get the most out of reading, critical skills and techniques. Chapter 10. How all teachers can and must be reading teachers. Reading is the skill. Teaching students to unlock the full meaning of the texts they read is the single most powerful outcome a teacher can foster. If your students can read well, they can essentially do anything. I've included this chapter on reading in the book to help all teachers, not just in certain classes, but across the school in every room, use the methods of champion reading teachers to structure reading in their classrooms and ensure that students do lots and lots of it, and in ways that maximize productivity. If you teach, no matter the subject, you have the opportunity and the obligation to ensure that your students read more and better. This opportunity will result in their being both more informed regarding the topic of your instruction and more effective assimilators and analyzers of information, better readers, in the future. It's a double investment, paying both short and long-term results. I have a friend whose father continually stressed the power of reading to him when he was growing up. To prove it, he pulled my friend out of school for several months, bought a series of books on building, even though he had previously been only moderately handy, and proceeded, with my friend alongside, to build a house, from foundation to shingles. My friend recalls sitting on beams in the twilight, he and his father reading aloud with great intensity on plumbing or framing or wiring, sometimes working through the complex passages 3 and 4 times. Schools, however, have increasingly come to teach reading in a more specific and more limited sense, as a mere noun, a specific subject area for intentional study. We train our English and literacy teachers to teach a subject called reading. Certainly, there's a great deal of value in thinking of reading as primarily a subject, particularly at the elementary level where phonics has, or should have, revolutionized the efficacy of early literacy instruction, and where specialized instruction is a key lever in creating lasting reading gains among students. But the value of reading arguably lies just as much in its status as a verb, that is, students reading frequently and broadly is a key goal of schooling. Not only do the reading programs and English classes in many schools fail to include much actual reading, in the verb sense, but untapped opportunities to read more effectively occur throughout every corner of the building. Still, schools are far less likely to maximize these opportunities, and even less likely to train teachers how to take advantage of them. Nevertheless, the overall value of the additional high-quality reading you could do in a typical school day could equal or possibly exceed the value of what happens in designated reading classes. When you stop to consider how much high-quality reading students might do outside reading class, the untapped potential is massive, but for now most students simply don't read much. Consider four of the most enduring intellects to have worked and written in the English language: Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Jane Austen, and Charles Dickens. They were all educated similarly, but perhaps not how you'd think. Each received little or no formal schooling. Essentially self-educated in an era when self-education meant reading, they rose to eminence by virtue of the skills and knowledge their private reading taught them. I am not suggesting that their educations provide a model of what education should be. Still, they remind us of the almost unlimited capacity of diligent reading to teach. For all four of these exceptional people and many others, mere reading was sufficient to foster and develop rare genius. And as for the rest of us, we are all self-educated, to some degree or another, by virtue of the reading we have done. Leafing back in my mind through the ideas gleaned from my private reading, I know that they have shaped me as much as my schooling has. We are what we have read and how we read it, and no other single activity has the capacity to yield so much educational value. And yet students in many schools spend precious little time actually reading. Likely, they read for less than an hour a day. Even in their reading or literature classes, they are as likely to talk about reading or respond to what they may or may not have read as they are to actually read. For her dissertation, a colleague followed students through their day at New York City public schools and found that they read for an average of 10 minutes per day. Worse, 40% of them did no reading at all. Making mere reading highly productive and effective in your classroom is a critical skill, no matter what subject or grade level you teach. And this chapter explains how you can do that, both practically, how you can ensure that classmates are reading along with the student who's reading aloud, and pedagogically, how and when you should ask what kinds of questions. It also contains guidance especially useful to English and language arts teachers whose goal is to use techniques like strategies to make students readers over and above their mastery of any specific text. Although I've tried to provide guidance for both teachers generally and specialists, I underscore two key assumptions in this chapter. Everybody in a school must be a reading teacher, and the generalist techniques must be the most productive for study by specialists. In many cases, they are highly trained in the subtle arts of interpretation and textual analysis, but leave value on the table due to a lack of proficiency. In other words, they may fall into the trap that many other specialists, heart surgeons or data analysts, for example, face. Losing sight of the basics. The point of this chapter is to bring those basics back into focus. As one excellent teacher said to me, "I'm a certified English teacher and a pretty good one at teaching kids to interpret what we read, but I don't know the first thing about what to do when a kid can't read a word." The chapters in Part 2 offer approaches for helping all students improve their reading. They cover a set of skills that is obvious to some practitioners, but where the approach taken by top teachers provides guidance that is critically important for all. Decoding, the process of deciphering written text to identify the spoken words it represents. Fluency, consists of automaticity, the ability to read at a rapid rate, plus expression, the ability to group words together into phrases to reflect meaning and tone. Vocabulary, a student's base of word knowledge, how many words she knows and how well she knows them. Comprehension. How much of what's written a student understands. Comprehension sits in a strange position within this list as it requires both a set of techniques of its own and also the mastery of the other three. You teach fluency, decoding, and vocabulary in order to ensure robust comprehension. However, when comprehension doesn't work, it may be that students weren't able to make certain inferences or distinguish trivial from critical details. But it's just as likely that the problem was that they couldn't read the passage with sufficient fluidity and automaticity to allow them to use their processing capacity to understand its subtleties. They may be using so much of their mental capacity bandwidth, merely processing the words, that they can't remember the beginning of the paragraph, or the sentence, by the time they get to the end. And it's important to remember that all students face this challenge. In the first year of my graduate studies in English literature, most of us were so busy trying to unpack the jargon of the field and the impenetrable syntax of academic writing that our comprehension sagged woefully. Not because we couldn't grasp the ideas, but because the presentation posed barriers to fluency, decoding, and vocabulary. And presentation can pose such barriers to every reader, no matter who, and often deliberately so. The novels of William Faulkner and Gabriel Garcia Marquez are good examples. The information in Part 2 focuses broadly on making reading more effective and rigorous in any classroom and for any purpose. Whether you're reading The Three Little Bears, Plato, Chapter 7 of Cell, The Building Blocks of Life, The Directions to a Math Problem, or a description of the Gettysburg Address. The guidance here is equally applicable to teachers of reading as a specific subject. However, since the art of teaching reading comprehension as a fungible skill that students learn to master and apply in any future situation is also the challenging and nuanced provenance of specialists, reading teachers, Part 2 also contains specific guidance for those teachers. The last chapter on comprehension also contains a discussion of aspects of reading that are more specifically, but not exclusively, relevant to language arts or reading classrooms. In particular, I discuss in this section the reading strategies so many reading teachers currently use. Making reading instruction productive and accountable. Control the game. So, how do busy teachers integrate reading instruction into their classrooms in a way that will be productive and keep students accountable? This challenge involves a set of skills that are often overlooked but are critically important. I call these skills control the game. Imagine, for a moment, a hypothetical school. This school values reading above all other endeavors, to an exaggerated degree. In its reading classes, it provides direct, intentional instruction on reading, phonics and comprehension at the lower grade levels, intentional focus on key terms and concepts like characterization and theme at the middle school level, introduction to college prep literature at the high school level, and vocabulary at all grade levels. It has recently decided to ensure that its students spend almost all their time in school reading. In science classes, they read chapters from articles and textbooks. In history class, they read primary and secondary source materials, often for the entire class period. They do write, but usually summaries and analyses of what they've read. In math, they supplement their problem sets with reading, and new concepts are often introduced in short descriptive texts. Imagine also that teachers in the school are able to consistently ensure that students, when asked to read, actually do read and read effectively and with attentiveness. As a result, students in the school read for 6 or 7 hours a day plus homework. I offer this prospect as a hypothetical model, not a proposal for actual educational programs. My goal is not to say I think it would make for a viable school model, but to cause you to reflect on what the results of such a school would be. Might reading for 6 or 7 hours a day, 190 days a year, if you could ensure the reading was of reasonable quality, achieve better outcomes than many schools today foster? Obviously, there's no way to answer this question. The fact is that the answer could plausibly be yes, and that the question, if we could ensure that students read well, would it be better to read, should be on our minds as teachers. If a teacher can ensure that her students can be relied on to read well, she can always, at any time and for any duration, ensure that a high-value activity, the single most important skill of the educated citizen, will take place in her classroom. If she can do that, she can consistently invest her time at a reliable rate of return. She need never oversee a low-value activity again. She has a hurdle rate, a rate of return she must exceed on an investment of her time to make it worthwhile. The term hurdle rate comes from finance. If you know you can predictably earn 10% on every dollar you invest in a certain bond, for example, and you know that bond is always available to you, you would naturally avoid any investment that returned you less than 10%, since you could always do better with your bond. The question you'd be asking in assessing any potential investment is not, will it make me money, but will it beat my hurdle rate? That is, you'd ask whether any investment would yield a stronger return than the best alternative investment you know you could make. Businesses ask this kind of question all the time. A technology firm's owners wouldn't ask, would building a new factory to manufacture cell phones make us money if its resources are limited? If its owners invest millions in building the cell phone factory, they must choose not to do something else with that money. Say, invest it in expanding their existing computer factory. Faced with the possibility of profits in cell phones, they would ask whether investing in a cell phone plant would exceed their hurdle rate. In this case, would building a factory to manufacture cell phones earn us more than would investing the money in expanding our current computer factories? The decision is a choice between the return you know you can get from your existing computer operations and the potential of any new project, the cell phones. If you could make an 8% return on the cell phone factory, it would still not make sense to do it if your rate of return was 10% for expanding computer operations. Just because you can make money manufacturing cell phones doesn't mean you should do it. Although we also manage finite resources as teachers, in this case time, we rarely think this way. We ask whether our actions will result in learning, but this is the wrong question. The right question is whether our actions yield a return that exceeds our hurdle rate. That is, yield more learning per minute invested than does the best reliable alternative use of class time. And we rarely spend time thinking about developing the strongest and most reliable hurdle rate. In the classrooms of many teachers whose teaching informed this book, meaningful reading, a term I'll define in a minute, provides an exceptionally strong and reliable hurdle rate. It's a high-quality activity, when done efficiently, that can be carried out in any classroom at any time and with limited additional preparation or expense required. You can always invest any stretch of time, short or long, in meaningful reading and reap a strong and predictable return. Furthermore, if you know you could always be doing meaningful reading, in any class at any time, you can examine your other investments of time critically. Do they exceed the value of meaningful reading? Are they potentially higher return, but riskier, and therefore should be balanced with something more reliable? As you ask these questions, you may well find that reading crowds out some of the other ways you invest your time. Surely not all of them, but probably some of them do not exceed your hurdle rate. That is, they are not reliably more productive than meaningful reading. It would be smarter to have them read meaningfully instead. It makes sense to pause here and define the term meaningful reading more specifically, because it is critical to this discussion. For the purposes of this book, I define meaningful reading as reading that is accountable, moderately expressive, and highly leveraged. By accountable, I mean that teachers are able to reliably assess whether students are actually reading, rather than, say, sitting looking at pictures or out the window daydreaming when they are supposed to be reading, and reading effectively, decoding and reading words correctly and diligently, for example, rather than re-inscribing errors such as ignoring suffixes or skipping over the difficult parts of the text. Much of the reading students do in schools fails to meet this criterion. In one commonly used program, Drop Everything and Read, or DEAR, for example, students are given quiet time in which they sit with books and are expected to read. It's a lovely idea, but if you observe students during this program, you will invariably see some of them sitting with books open, but eyes drifting across the room or out the window. Some flip idly through pages, gazing at pictures, while others read lazily or poorly, practicing and re-inscribing weak habits as they go. Unfortunately, the students reading least are often the ones who need to read the most. This fails the accountability test. As a result, the rate of return on this activity may be low. Learning to invest reading with a strong dose of accountability is a key focus of this chapter. By moderately expressive, I mean that students demonstrate the capacity to embed meaning in words as they read, to show in their inflection that they are processing the words at a level beyond the most basic level. We're not talking about Sir John Gielgud here, just the basics. Non-robotic reading with demonstrated recognition of punctuation and periodic recognition by emphasis of key words. Although expressive reading is insufficient to the final task of a full and rich understanding of a text, it is highly efficient as an indicator of basic understanding. Expressing the meaning and register of the words in the manner you are reading them demonstrates comprehension, the end goal of reading instruction. Many teachers scorn the idea of allowing a single student to read aloud during class time. What are the other kids doing? They ask. In meaningful reading, the answer is that they are also reading, to themselves, in step with the student reading aloud. I call the degree to which other students are reading leverage, and it's the third critical element of meaningful reading. If one student is reading aloud and her classmates are listening passively, there's a leverage factor of one, signifying a highly inefficient activity. However, if one student is reading aloud and 25 students are silently but accountably reading along with her at their desks, you have a leverage factor of 26. 26 people reading makes for a highly efficient and worthwhile activity. If 26 people are reading, your hurdle rate is much, much higher, so the question becomes very quickly, how do you get that leverage? The Control the Game skills explain how to get and sustain consistently high rates of leverage. When they are reading, everyone reads and reads accountably, with the result being an especially high hurdle rate, and over time, consistently higher value activities in the classroom, because the hurdle rate raises the investment criteria for their time. Skeptics about the efficacy of having a single student reading out loud might ask how the text could be appropriately leveled for the whole class, or whether it was injurious to students' self-esteem if they struggled publicly. Without engaging in an extended philosophical debate, I would argue that there is nothing inherently injurious to self-esteem about getting something wrong, especially if students learn to do it successfully over time. In that case, the opposite is probably the outcome. Regardless, as Roy Baumeister has demonstrated in his excellent article on the topic, Rethinking Self-Esteem, Why Nonprofits Should Stop Pushing Self-Esteem and Start Endorsing Self-Control, Stanford Social Innovation Review, Winter 2005, there's little to support the idea that enhancing self-esteem is a worthy goal in schools. The best you can say is that it correlates to, rather than causes, achievement. That is, when students achieve, they believe in themselves, not the other way around. As for leveled texts, many to most of the top-performing urban charter schools of which I'm aware buck the otherwise orthodox belief in heterogeneous classroom grouping and solve this problem by homogeneously grouping classes. That said, even if you do or cannot homogeneously group, a bit of pre-screening can help you target sections of the text to appropriate readers or even to prepare struggling readers by introducing phrases and words in advance for them. Once you've mastered Control the Game and can reliably achieve a fully leveraged and meaningful read, you too can use that skill to set your hurdle rate and rigorously assess whether your classroom activities exceed it in value. I am confident that you will find many such things. You will do a lot more than just read. But you should always seek to consider your hurdle rate and subject every other activity to a comparison. Furthermore, I acknowledge that as students gain in maturity and proficiency, the definition of meaningful reading may change. Silent individual reading that doesn't test as explicitly for accountability may become more frequent, for example. But the skills described in this chapter are critical because they get students to the point in their academic careers where high-value independent reading is possible, and they increase the value of those sessions if invested in systematically. Also, most urban public schools probably fail to get the majority of their students to the point where their independent reading is fully meaningful and productive. In those schools, reading falls victim to the logistical problems of poor accountability and low leverage. I fervently hope your classroom reaches the point where Control the Game is unnecessary and less productive than mere silent reading. It will be a joyous day when more classrooms do not need to manage reading in this way. I would merely caution you against assuming you have that classroom without further evidence from and training of your students, possibly over multiple years. Control the game skills. Keep durations unpredictable. When you ask a student to read aloud during class, that student is the primary reader. As the designation suggests, this student is not the only reader. While the practice the primary reader gets is critical, the actions and focus of all other students are also critical. They must become secondary readers. So when you identify your primary reader, don't specify how long you want him to read before he actually begins. "Start reading for me, please, James," or "Pick up, please, James," is far better than is "Read the next paragraph for me, James." This ensures that other students in the class don't know when a new reader will be asked to pick up and therefore provides them with a strong incentive to follow along carefully. This makes them more likely to be secondary readers. In addition, keeping duration unpredictable allows you to address an overmatched primary reader in a non-invasive manner. A primary reader who struggles mightily with a long paragraph risks losing the engagement and concentration of his or her peers, who may lose track of the narrative thread. This reduces leverage. When you've committed to a full paragraph, you lose your ability to cut a primary reader's session short and have him or her try again with a better passage without it becoming obvious. If you don't specify the length of the read, you can shorten or lengthen as you need to in the interest of both the primary reader and the rest of the class. Keep the identity of the next reader unpredictable. If you move quickly from one primary reader to another, students focus more closely on following along. This is doubly true if they don't know who the next primary reader will be. A teacher who announces that she'll go around the room in a predictable fashion gives away this part of her leverage. Students can tune out until their turn is near. Holding on to your ability to choose the next reader also allows you to match students to passages more effectively. Retaining unpredictability makes for better leverage and better reading. Keep durations short. Reading for short segments maximizes the concentration of the primary reader. It allows students to invest expressive energy in reading and focus intently on and sustain fluent and even dramatic reading. This yields higher quality oral reading and makes the lesson more engaging. Moving quickly among primary readers also keeps the pacing lively. The lesson feels quick and energetic as a result, rather than tedious and slow. Knowing that segments tend to be short and may end at any time because they aren't predictable also reinforces for secondary readers that they will likely soon get a chance themselves to read, and this keeps them from tuning out. Keeping durations short allows you to take better advantage of a crucial form of data. Every time you switch readers, you gather data about your leverage. When you say, "Pick up please, Charles," and Charles jumps in with the next sentence without missing a beat, you know Charles was reading alongside the previous reader on his own. Ideally, you want this sort of seamless transition every time you switch readers, and switching frequently allows you to gather and manage this more frequently and broadly. The more data you have, the more information and tools you will have to help you ensure leverage. Reduce transaction costs. A transaction cost is the amount of resources needed to execute an exchange. It can be economic, verbal, or something else. If it takes you 3 days of driving to different stores to find the best price on a TV, your transaction cost is high, 3 days of your time, possibly higher in dollar value than the potential savings you'd get from buying the less expensive TV. When you manage finite resources like time and attention, as teachers do, transaction costs are both critically important and easy to miss. A shopper spending 3 days searching for a $20 savings on a TV might think he's gotten a steal, but if he spent one of those days working and then bought the more expensive TV, he'd have both more than $10 and 2 days left over. A transaction cost is implicit in every transition in the classroom, especially in transitions you make frequently, like moving from one reader to the next. Still, many teachers fail to recognize their significance. A transaction that takes more than a few seconds steals reading time and risks interrupting the continuity of what the students are reading, thus affecting how well students follow and comprehend the text. Make it your goal to transition from one primary reader to another quickly and with a minimum of words, and ideally in a consistent way. Susan, pick up is a much more efficient transition than thank you, Stephen, nicely read. Susan, will you begin reading, please? Since it's more than three times as quick, the first transaction reduces threefold the amount of time students are not reading. It also keeps the narrative thread vibrant and alive in students' minds, since it's subject to less interruption. Because it's quick, it also allows you to step in and use it at almost any natural pause in the text, which gives you more control over when to choose a new primary reader. Use bridging to maintain continuity. In bridging, a teacher reads a short segment of text, a bridge, between primary student readers. In a typical sequence of bridging, a teacher might allow Stuart to read for three sentences and then read one sentence herself. Then she might allow Mary to read four sentences and read two sentences herself, before asking John to read for six sentences and reading one herself, and then passing off to Jane. The benefit of this method is that it moves the story along quickly and keeps the narrative thread alive, while interspersing teacher-quality expressive reading, which maximizes comprehension. I am arguing for discretionary bridging when it's important to keep the narrative thread alive and create more opportunities to model. Generally, the harder the text, the more you might consider bridging. But you needn't necessarily always bridge. Oral close. I learned the oral close technique from watching Roberto de Leon teach reading to third-grade boys at Excellence Charter School for Boys in Bedford-Stuyvesant. In one example, de Leon kicked off his reading of Phantom of the Opera by leaving a word out at the end of the first sentence. Carlotta had the, he read, snapping quietly on the word the to alert his students that they should fill in the blank. On the day in question, only a handful of his boys chimed in leading role exactly on cue. So Rob started over. Ooh, some boys weren't quite with us. Let's try that again. Carlotta had the, and all his boys chimed in with leading role, demonstrating that they were now following along. This quick device, which de Leon uses throughout his lessons, allows him to quickly and simply assess leverage. Rely on a placeholder. As the best reading teachers move between reading and questioning their students about what they read, they use quick and reliable prompts to ensure that their students recognize the transition and react promptly. I call this prompt a placeholder because it is used to ensure that students retain their place in the text so they can quickly and immediately transition back to reading after discussion. Hold your place, track me, announces Patrick Pastor, modeling for his sixth graders how to point to the spot where they left off reading Esperanza Rising, close their books partway, and engage his eyes to show they are ready to discuss. After a brief discussion of why Esperanza and Miguel react differently to a train ride, he instructs, "Pick up reading, please, Melanie." In less than 2 seconds, she and her classmates are back into the book at almost no transaction cost. "Finger in your book, close your book," intones de Leon as he prepares his students to discuss Phantom of the Opera, and also prepares them to end that discussion and return to the book efficiently. Leadership Prep's Hannah Loftus uses a similar expression, finger freeze, with her third graders, modeling for them how to keep their place when the reading is interrupted. Chapter 11. The Fundamentals. Teaching Decoding, Vocabulary Development, and Fluency. Once you've mastered the skills in Chapter 10 and have your students reading more frequently and with greater leverage, mastering the methods of champion teachers in three core elements of literacy instruction, decoding, vocabulary, and fluency, can increase the quality and productivity of your students' reading, make them more attentive, more expressive readers, and building a foundation that will increase the comprehension they take from their reading, no matter what subject you teach. Decoding. Decoding is the process of deciphering written text to identify the spoken words it represents. Although decoding might appear at first to be a mundane, lower-order skill, its mastery is a prerequisite to all reading comprehension, and thus to most learning. It's the foundation. Incomplete mastery of decoding can persist well beyond the elementary grades and detract from the success of even apparently advanced students. If a third-grade student labors over just two or three of the words in a sentence, concentrating his energy on piecing together each letter's contribution, he will likely have little memory left over to absorb the meaning of the sentence, or even to remember the beginning by the time he reaches the end. If a middle school student in history class reads a passage about the causes of the Civil War, but leaves the S off the verbs, the syntax of the sentence will erode. The student may remember pieces of the main point, but will fail to develop a cohesive understanding. If a high school student allocates much of her mental energy to sounding out new terms in a passage about representative government, filibuster, cloture, and perquisite, she may fail to attend to much else or even imprint the words' meanings. If she gets the names or words wrong or breezes over them with only the roughest approximations, she may fail to recognize them in future discussion, conversation, or reading. Given the bedrock importance of decoding at every level, teachers should strive to correct decoding errors whenever possible, no matter what subject or grade level they teach. Since these errors often indicate a broader lack of knowledge or skills, reinforcing general rules and ensuring that students practice decoding are the antidotes. However, many teachers who correct decoding errors fail to do either of these, opting instead to correct the error and ask the student to make an echo correction, that is, to repeat the correct word without decoding it. There are times when an echo correction is necessary, but it only gets the student through the word in the immediate situation. It doesn't increase the likelihood of success the next time the student encounters the word. So what sorts of actions are better than an echo correction? If a student can't read might, M-I-G-H-T, the best way to correct such a decoding error may be to improve her knowledge of the rules. After all, she's likely to struggle with sight and tight as well. Rather than saying that word is might, the teacher might say, I-G-H-T says it. Now try that word again. This has two benefits. It requires the student to incorporate the new information and then decode the original word successfully, and it reinforces a rule she can use on other high-frequency words. The next time the teacher corrects, he or she might say, I-G-H-T says, and ask the student to recall and then apply the rule. In most cases, asking students to self-correct by applying a rule or new information, that vowel is a long A, now try that word again, is another typical example, is powerful because it addresses the cause, not just the symptom, and thus contributes to a long-term solution. Even so, exceptions are the rule in English, arguably one of our language's most distinguishing characteristics. Many words are simply impossible or unrewarding to decode. In fact, sight words are often learned by rote, specifically because rules do not apply to them. Where the ideal of self-correcting isn't possible, the key is to recognize such cases quickly so as not to waste time and create confusion. Transaction costs and decoding. A transaction cost is the amount of resources it takes to execute an exchange, be it economic, verbal, or something else. Think again of the $10 savings on the TV in the example in Chapter 10. Transaction costs are most important in those interactions that happen frequently, since frequency multiplies the importance of efficiency. This makes managing transaction costs especially relevant to addressing decoding errors. Decoding errors are common and usually of short duration. A student reads hope as hop, and the whole sequence, whether it gets corrected or not, lasts just a second or two. Correcting decoding errors consistently is important in helping your students build strong reading habits, and reducing the transaction cost of your corrections is arguably the most important factor in your success, not just in improving students' decoding skills, but in ensuring a successful lesson overall.